Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
Now, while the Swifties were waiting for a new album from Taylor, book fans have been enthusiastically marking today in the calendar for the latest novel from Mr. David Nicholls. Booker, long-listed author, global best-selling author of One Day, screenwriter of note, and all of that. It finally arrives today. It's called You Are Here, and it's very good. David joins us from BBC Broadcasting House in London. Good morning, sir.
Hi, Oliver. Hi, nice to talk to you.
Feverish anticipation day. Are you nervous on a day like today?
I am. I'm just starting to talk about the book to readers and you never quite know how people are going to respond, but I really love this one and it was a real joy to write, so I'm hopeful that people will like it.
The phenomenon around One Day is so huge. I mean, even the publicity material that your people have sent us around this novel, You Are Here, is about One Day on Netflix.
Yes.
So did that loom over you while writing You Are Here?
I had a certain distance from the Netflix One Day. I wrote one episode and I was an exec producer, but I tried to keep my head down and get on with the novel. And yeah, it's sort of always there with everything I write, really. I love One Day. I'm very proud of it.
Yes.
I'm sure I'll always be author of One Day, David Nicholls, and that's great. I don't mind at all. At the same time, you know, this book is a sort of development. It's the next stage of life. It's a slightly more of a chamber piece, more of a mellow novel, a more mature novel. I can see that it complements One Day while at the same time being different.
It's interesting to hear you say that you think you'll always be seen as One Day author, David Nicholls.
Yeah.
Will that devalue some of the work? You've done a lot of work since then, of course. It's 2009, the novel comes out. Are you worried at all, though, that it almost devalues everything that comes later?
No. No, I mean, genuinely not. I really love it. And it brings a readership to the new books. And, you know, I think the new books are much, much better written. I much prefer You Are Here to One Day. But I'm also very, very, very fond of that book and very, very grateful for the security it's given me and the audience it's brought for me, and I'm very grateful also to everyone who made the show, because that was such a brilliant experience for me as a novelist to feel that it was in good hands and to enjoy the process.
You think your work is better since? How better?
I just am a little bit more careful with the editing process, a little bit more thorough. I take my time a little bit more. I just feel a little bit I suppose you grow up and you learn things along the way as a writer. You never quite learn how to do it. It always presents challenges. But I think I've become a bit cannier about technique and a bit more careful sentence by sentence. And I'm very proud of those later books as well, and very happy for that One Day brings a readership to those as well.
Well, we say later books, but you're not exactly an elderly gent of literature at this stage.
No, listen to me talking about my oof.
I'm just one reader now, but I did sort of dread the task initially because I don't think I'm a romantic story enthusiast.
Yeah.
But I really, really enjoyed this story because it's not really, you know, there's a lot more to it just than romance. There's a lot of stuff about family in here. It's a lovely walk with your characters going coast to coast or cover to cover as we do, mostly because it's very funny.
Yes, thank you. I mean, I did put a lot of work into making sure that it's definitely the funniest of them, I think. I mean, it is shot through with this kind of melancholy and sadness, and both Michael and Marnie, you know, are carrying a lot of emotional baggage, is the cliche, isn't it? But it's literal in this book. They're carrying the weight of these failed relationships, and they're both in a bad place when they start the walk. And yet, I did want it to be hopeful and joyous. And Marnie, in particular, is a very witty character.
Yeah.
The great thing about writing fiction is you can take your time and you can make the characters as witty as you like because you have years and years and years to polish their dialogue and their jokes. And I loved writing Marnie. I loved her view of the world, her cynicism and her spark.
She's 38 years old. She's just been separated from a rotter of a fella.
Yeah.
But she is so funny. I mean, I absolutely loved Marnie as well. She's even trying to come up with a joke at one stage during sex.
Yes. Yeah. I should one day write a sex scene that's just completely deadpan, serious and erotic. And this isn't it. This is her distracted, trying to be in the moment, but distracted by the Radio 3 arts review programme that's playing in the background, not quite in the moment.
And someone in the B&B slipping notes under the doors and so on.
Yes, yes.
So how did Marnie manage to live inside your head?
I spend a long time writing the characters' biographies and thinking a lot about their tone of voice and their physicality and their background and what they wear and what they read and what they love. And I do a lot of sketching before I actually write the character in the official document. I don't write chapter one until there's about 20 or 30,000 words worth of notes.
So really?
It's a bit like preparing for a play, I guess. You know, yeah. You do all that preparation and make sure the character is rounded, and then you place them in the situation, and then it's much easier to write. I don't discover character as I go. I know who they are fully formed before I tell the story.
And Michael, the character, I mean, he's a difficult character, I would imagine, when you're putting it down on paper. How are people going to like this character? Because you could become fed up with just his sadness.
Yeah, he's been through a lot, and he's a little bit bruised. His relationship, his marriage is broken up. He's still in love with Natasha, his perhaps soon to be ex-wife. There are various things in his past that he's carrying with him. Definitely in the first draft, it was almost like funny chapter, sad chapter, funny chapter, sad chapter. And my very brilliant editor said, you know, can we make Michael a little bit warmer, a little bit funnier, and Ryan kinder? So I think he has a certain self-awareness, and Marnie brings him out of himself and makes him laugh again and changes his view of the world. And it's in that sense, it's a very traditional love story. I like the idea of a conversation bringing people to the surface and allowing them to open up and reveal more of themselves as the walk goes on.
And one of the ways you kind of makes fun of himself is the fact that he's a geography teacher and lives up to every stereotype imaginable they set off on this long walk together with friends that leave eventually the two of them together.
Yes, they set out it's meant to be a group walking weekend, and Michael is intending to walk the coast to coast, which is a very famous, beautiful walk from St. Bees Head in Cumbria to the Yorkshire coast. And he wants to just get rid of everyone, but Marnie, for various reasons, tags along. And as the walk continues, I like the idea that you can map a relationship literally. So each of the chapters begins with the map that corresponds to that day's walking. And as the days pass, their relationship changes and they gradually reveal themselves to each other.
It's quite lovely and delicate, and we get very emotionally involved with these characters because of the way it's so cleverly mapped out. You're wondering, because she's constantly speculating about dropping out, isn't she? She's supposed to leave at any moment.
Marnie is a Londoner. She's one of those Londoners who rarely steps out in the rain. She works at home. She's become quite antisocial. She's wonderful and full of jokes and life, but she's become a little bit shy and introverted. And she's very, very, very sceptical about the whole idea of nature and landscape. I didn't want to write... If you write a book about two people who love walking, going on a walk, there's nothing really to write about. There's no friction. So for a lot of it, Marnie really, really doesn't want to be there. But as the days go by, she changes and relaxes into it and loves it. And it's something I love too, so it was easy to write that passion.
So there's the yearning that they both have is basically the hope, isn't it, that this is not going to end miserably, hopefully, for these characters, or we're not hanging out with two miserable characters because they still want to live.
Yeah, it's initially about two people who've kind of given up on the idea of romantic love and have found ways, or are trying to find ways, to be by themselves in a way that's sustainable and happy and not miserable. I didn't want solitude to be the enemy. It is a book about loneliness, but I didn't want, you know, often with romantic comedies, it's the worst thing that can possibly happen to you, not being in a romantic relationship. And I wanted to be a little bit more positive about that. So Marnie in particular has found a way to throw herself into her work and into books and to be happy. And at the same time, both of them are holding out for the possibility of change, of meeting someone else and of leading a different life.
And you have this cheeky fun because Marnie is a book editor and she's editing a very bad novel.
Yes, she's a copy editor and she has to edit this erotic novel full of kind of murder and orgies as she goes on this incredibly sexless holiday in the rain in the English countryside. So it's about the gap between the fantasy world that she's editing and the real world that she's sort of stomping through in a very bad mood.
There's a slight danger, isn't there, with the Michael character, because he's suffering this crisis of loneliness. There's an emasculating incident at one point that sort of half explains what's going on. But you're portraying the sort of the type of man who's getting quite a bit of attention these days from online gurus.
I guess so. I did want to take the issue of male loneliness seriously, and there is a, to a degree, the book is about depression and the aftermath of trauma, and Michael and his wife have struggled with fertility issues as well, and I want to give all of that proper weight, but not in a kind of aggressive man's rights kind of way, just as a subject that a lot of men grapple with. I most of my books, the readership of my books is largely female, but I love it when men can see themselves in stories that are fundamentally love stories, but that they can still identify and recognize the emotions.
But they say that you're writing the novels that makes men cry.
I like them to be emotional without being sentimental or mawkish or melodramatic. I'm very happy for readers to become emotionally connected to the characters, and that's a great plus. But I never want to be, tear jerking in a way that feels manipulative. Yeah.
Are you a crier yourself, David Nicholls?
It has happened. No, it does happen. Particularly, I watch a lot of films and television, and I do sometimes have to slip my my hand over my eyes. Yeah.
Just make sure not to speak so they catch in your throat, or just start clearing your throat in a very manly fashion.
Yes.
What would make you cry watching TV or film?
Oh, I'm just trying to think. The last thing I'm going to go completely blank and not be able to recall anything at all. But it was unexpected. It was Chinatown. I'd forgotten the end of Chinatown and how powerful that is.
Jack Nicholson movie.
Yeah, there's an extraordinary scene which unlocks the mystery, and Faye Dunaway is so amazing in it, and I found it shocking and weirdly moving. So that was the last time.
That is fat. That's an insight now into your.
It
your
is.
As if your novel.
It took me by surprise. I must admit, but. Yeah,
a gorgeous film. That's a good one. That's a good
it
one
is
to
an
cry.
Amazing film. Yeah,
that's a good one to cry. There's some great stuff about rich guys and everything in there. But nobody's wealthy in this novel.
No. It's very much two normal people who have nevertheless very rich, I hope, inner lives.
Are you someone who enjoys solitude yourself?
I do. Most of my working day is spent in solitude, and sometimes that's tough. You get very lonely and you think, well, maybe I'll jump on social media and see if I can communicate with someone there. But that's not always the best solution. A lot of the time I love the peace and quiet that I need to write fiction. But then when I work on TV or film, it's the opposite. It's very, very noisy.
Yes.
It's very collaborative, often quite fraught and tense because there's so much pressure. And I enjoy that too, but there's always a nice moment when I can go back to my office and close the door and get on with work. Outside of work, I go on this once or twice a year. I go on long walks by myself, rather like Michael, where I walk for 3 or 4 or 5 days and just think and read and try to stay offline. And that's something I really, really love. But there's definitely a point where I think I just want to be home now. After about 3 days, I usually am thinking, time to get back to it.
You need to go home, because you're not a lonely man. You have a wife and two kids.
I do, yeah. I'm very, very lucky to have that, to go back to. It's something I take a lot of pleasure from, so yeah.
So when you come from a happy home, what sets you off for those lonely walks?
I think it's a normal, noisy household, and sometimes it's hard to get the thinking time. You're always or engaged in the kids' schoolwork or what you're going to eat that night or the bills. And it's sometimes nice just to have a little bit of solitary time to think mainly about work and just jot some ideas down perhaps and not worry about the kind of domestic churn. Which isn't something I love and also embrace. But just once or twice a year, I like to get away.
Oh, once or twice a year. I'm wondering, are writers the only people who get to say, are allowed to go and do that? I need 4 days away silently.
Yes, it's a work thing.
It seems like I don't think someone who works down mines or something are allowed.
No, it is a little bit self-indulgent, I'm sure. Yeah.
But it's good to get away with it.
Yeah.
You say.
Yeah.
Speaking of the noise and calamity, or cacophony, I should say, of working on TV and film. You are here. Are there plans already to adapt that to the screen? We're reading here and there that might be something that Netflix are thinking about.
Yes, there are a few conversations about it. Yeah, it's a tricky one to adapt because so much of it is in the characters' heads. It's not all expressed,
yes.
And that's always the biggest challenge, adapting a book where a lot of it is observational, where there isn't necessarily. I mean, there is a story. There are lots of events along the way, but it's something that we are thinking and talking about. Yeah,
And of course you'll have the landscape. Going coast to coast.
Landscape, yeah, which is beautiful. I mean, I did the walk myself for research so that I could work out where they're standing when they argue or tell a joke or to be very, very specific about events and map them on the real world. That was a really good experience. And I did it in the three stages, and it's a walk which almost has three acts. It's the lakes and then the Pennines and the Dales and then the Yorkshire Moors at the end. It's a wonderful walk. But I couldn't take the time off to do it in one go, so I did it in three installments.
Are you jotting notes as you're walking, or do you wait for the evening time and
I take a lot of photographs along the way, and then when I get back to the hotel, I jot down anything that seems like a good idea. Yeah.
Interesting. Trying not to slow the walk down too much.
Yeah.
Three or four
yeah.
stages, so they're a couple of days at a time, I take it. Because it's...
Yes, I did it. If you're a pretty fast walker, you can do 4 days of walking in the lakes, then cross the Pennines for 4 days into the Dales, and then the last 4 days is the beautiful, rather sometimes quite bleak North York Moors, and then you just travel down the beautiful North Yorkshire coast, and it ends in Robin Hood's Bay, which is a lovely little town. You walk down the slipway and you dip your toes in the water and you drop your pebble that you've carried all the way across the country, and that's the official end of the walk.
No, it's gorgeous. It beautifully rendered the whole walk and the landscape and everything in the novel. And there's lots of nods, indeed direct references to A Room with a View.
Yes, that's a novel I really, really loved. And again, it's about landscape and the idea of a view as something hopeful, something to reach for. I love the wry, ironic tone of that novel. And the novel, it's a wonderful film, but the novel in particular has a brilliant, sharp, funny tone. So it's a comedy, but it's about serious things and it has a real emotion as well. And it's a novel that I thought about a lot while I was writing this one.
And what is the view that we're sort of searching for?
Well, I don't know. It's always hard to talk about metaphors without sounding pretentious. In that novel,
again, you're a writer. You get 4 days solitude and you can be pretentious. The allowances, don't forget.
I think in the Forster novel, this sounds like an A-level essay, but it's something to do with open-mindedness and breaking out of the society's conventions for the female character in that novel. And in this novel, it's to do with a hope for the future, I think. I wanted to write something that was joyous and hopeful and really, really funny, even while it contained moments of pathos and sadness.
That's great. No, you nailed it. No pretentiousness there at all, I can tell you.
Good.
You've said before you only managed to produce a new novel every 4 or 5 years.
That's about the pace, yeah. When I started off, my contract said I was going to do one a year. And I realized very quickly that I didn't have that kind of imagination. And so I often have to take a little time to think of what world I want to write about. Sweet Sorrow, the previous novel, was about amateur theatre and young love, first love, and the end of summer. And this is a novel about spring and about the time in your life where you're not quite where you expected to be and working out, I mean, that's why it's called You Are Here, working out whether you're happy or whether there's something missing and how you might achieve that. So it's a midlife book, but hopefully, yes, as I said, hopefully upbeat and joyous and hopeful.
No, it absolutely is. No, and I'm sure you say you're nervous on days like this, but I think your job is done, because even one day is still a bestseller, even in Ireland right now as we speak.
Yes, that's been great.
But David Nicholls, thank you so much. I've enjoyed our stroll this morning.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure to talk to you.
It's called You Are Here. It is out today, this very day. Go well and enjoy your walks and enjoy your moments of solitude where you can.
Thank you very much. Thank
Best
you.
Wishes. Thank you so much. 51551, that's our text.
Email oliver@rte.ie.